Good morning, everybody. It always takes a couple of seconds to get used to this sea of faces here. Don't worry, says Thron. Easier said than done, brother. Yeah. And I just want to have a go, just like a public reprimand of Christo, because I think it's very unfair getting France and then making you follow France. Yeah, especially France has brought this wonderful message and this big building up message this morning. And I have a confession to make that I am, my mission today is to convince you that you are, and me, that you are merely a termite. So, by the time you leave here, I really hope that you will be pleased also to be a termite. Yeah. But let's see where it goes. I actually want to speak about doubt. And I have a little challenge for you. Who thinks doubt is a sin? Few hands, eh? A couple of hands. And I want to confess then that I am one of these sinners because I struggle with doubt. And so I want to testify a little bit about this doubt. I was reading post-Pentecost at the end of Matthew. You can read it, but the disciples are all together. And Jesus is with them, and they're in Galilee, and they worship him. And it's a very frustrating thing, because it says, but some doubted. And it doesn't tell you what they doubted. It just says, some of them doubted. Right from the beginning in Genesis also, you hear, did God really say that? Thomas, I think that he gets a really bad rap in Afrikaans because he's called Thomas the ongelovige, the unbeliever, the, you know. In English, I think it's a bit more gentle. They say Thomas is the doubter, doubting Thomas. He doubted the resurrection. He said, this is an impossible thing because me, in my human brain, this thing is an impossibility. And when the other disciples said to him, we've seen the Lord. Thomas, for me, is a wonderful comfort because Thomas knew that the Lord was killed. He then challenges the rest of them and he says to them, unless I see my eyes, my senses, unless my senses are satisfied about this thing, I won't believe it. And Jesus does a wonderful thing with him. He says to him, come. Give me your hand. Put it here into my side. Have a look at the nail holes. And Thomas is unlocked. He doubted, and Jesus was merciful with him. The book of Jude tells us, it says, be merciful with those that doubt. Peter, we heard about Peter again this morning in Matthew 14. he progresses very well across the water up to a point. And then he realized what he was doing. And the Lord had to grab him, pull him back into the boat. He said to him, "Why did you doubt?" Peter would have answered, "Because I'm a person. You know, these are things that shouldn't happen." In Luke 7, 18 to 23, you can go and read there about another big doubter. His name was John the Baptist. And he sent two of his disciples, and he sent them to Jesus, and he sent them to Jesus to ask Jesus, "Are you the one, or must we look for somebody else?" John the Baptist. How did Jesus answer him? He says to these two guys, "Go and tell John what you have seen with your eyes. And all the messianic prophecy about about what the Messiah would do are incorporated in those verses. The captives are liberated, the blind see, the dead are raised. Go and tell him that you've seen that." The Psalms are full of doubt. They're called the Lamentation Psalms. And they have a structure, and you'll recognize the structure. It's the address at the beginning, it's, "O Lord." Then it's the complaint. It says, "You have turned your face from me." Then there's the petition in the thing. And some of these petitions, when you read them, you think, "Sure, I won't talk to God like that." Because they said to him, "Now, turn your face to me and answer me." And all of them, apparently, I researched this, I didn't know it, but only Psalm 88 doesn't end with, praising God at the end of it. But most of them end up saying, "But you are God, and I submit myself to this fact." Now, one of these psalms is Psalm 22. Let's go there quickly. My God, why have you forsaken me?" And we all know those words because those were the words of Jesus on the cross. Just before he died, he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Why this doubt topic is in my head? Because if it is a sin, I see that there have been a lot of people before me that have committed this same sin. And I've come to the conclusion that doubt, surely it cannot be a sin. Surely we all struggle with doubt. I've got some issues that I've been praying for years. And like my old father used to say, "Boy, I've stopped praying. I just nag." And sometimes I feel like that, you know, that I'm just nagging God. Not only do you have these things about unanswered prayer, you have things like you hear a report that your good friend Hugo Krock, his grandchild of 3 years old, has been taken. And it just causes so many questions. And you and I know what the answer is. It's like the Psalms. We'll go and we'll have all of these questions and these unanswered things that we're struggling with. Yeah. And the Psalms have got the recipe for this thing. Blessed is he who believes who has not seen. There is something that we cannot see and cannot know. And it sounds like a cop-out to say that this is a deeper verborgenheit, it's a deep mystery. I want to give you some mechanical examples of how I, how I just know that there is so much more than outside of my senses. Soveel meer as wat my sintuie kan ervaar. Okay, so we've got senses. All of us have got senses. We can touch things and we can feel. And we can see things because there's light coming at us. We can hear things. So you... There are other things also that neurological science talks about. They're starting to recognize things like intuition, for example. You know, just sixth sense. They can't really describe it to you. So let's rely just on the senses, and I'm going to take two here and fiddle with them a little bit. God said in Genesis 1, the first evidence that we have of God in the Bible, he says, let there be light. Do you know what light is? And we say, yes, it's when the sun comes up or we shine a torch or something like that. Light is, it's an unbelievable thing. Okay? If you take a beam of light and you shine it through a prism, a glass prism, it disperses into colors. So all of this light around us over here, it's full of colors. Okay. And I can see lots of some of the colors I can see. Probably I'm colorblind, you see. So some of the colors in front of me over here, I can see them. You can see them in a rainbow. The atmosphere is a prism, so the light comes shining into it and it splits it into the different colors. Okay. And on the one side of visible light for us, we've got blues and violets. And on the other side, we've got reds. Okay. And if you wear a red shirt, people can see it. But now if I ask you, if you had to wear an infrared shirt to church, none of us could see it. If you had an ultraviolet shirt on, none of us could see it. Because on the one side, infrared is not visible to the naked human eye. We need to fiddle with lenses to be able to see it. Ultraviolet, the same thing. Okay? So we can add a little bit of light on each side by using fancy lenses. But basically, all of us here, except me, have got a range from blue to red. Now, let me tell you a statistic. That band of visible light that humanity has been blessed with, that band that enables your heart to sing when you see a field of flowers or the contrasts of, as the hymn says, the purple-headed mountain with the river running past it. Yeah. The psalmist that writes that creation sings of the glory of God. And he's enabled to write that because his senses have taught him this thing. He's looked at it and he's seen the colors and the majesty and everything around it like that. This range of colors that we can see of the total light spectrum Who wants to guess a percentage? What percent of light is visible to us as humans? 4%. I've got a 0.01 there. Should we have an auction? Going, 4%. People, 0.0035% of all light that is shining on you when you walk outside there is visible to you. Go and Google it, I promise you. Can you imagine if you could see 0.01% of all light? Can you imagine the dimension of what you would see in front of you? It boggles my mind. Let me take this electromagnetic light. Let me take it just a couple of steps further off to one side. With an X-ray, it's light. The X-ray is all over him. With an X-ray, we can look through people. Now, these are the things that we know about. Okay, and an X-ray is still probably here at round about 0.1 away from what we can see. Sound is the same thing. Sound is another thing. It's an interesting thing. Sound has to travel through something. So it travels through air now, or travels through water, or through wood. But I don't know what the percentage of this is, because sound is... It's measured differently, but it's a tiny band of sound that we can hear. If you take, you've got infrasound and you've got ultrasound, like infrared and ultraviolet. You've got sound that does the same thing. And these are frequencies that you can't hear. So you can go very deep until there's a limit in depth. Or you can go very deep. Until there's a limit in how high you can hear. And as you get older, obviously, you start losing all those high frequencies. Yeah. But there are animals out there that operate within these boundaries. Bats. They don't even see. They just squeak their way around. Elephants. Elephants have got deep bass rumblings that they actually apparently feel through their feet. And you're completely unaware that a bat is communicating around you, and you're completely unaware of the elephant communicating around you, or the whale, or the beluga, or the river dolphin. Because these things are outside of the parameters of your own senses. So, and now comes the part where I'm going to try and convince you that you're a termite. No, actually, it's just a metaphor. David Attenborough, we all, I'm sure, know David Attenborough from Nature Channel things. He was asked whether he believed in God. And Attenborough said, the God of the Bible, no, I don't. And he equated then horrible things happening to nice people. And that's the reason that he gave, that he doesn't believe in the God of the Bible. He uses an example of a parasite. It's called river blindness, and it happens in West Africa, where there's a parasite that bores into people's eyes and makes them blind. And because of that parasite, he does not believe in the God of the Bible. So the interviewer says to him, are you an atheist then? He said, oh no, I don't have that confidence. And this was the most marvelous thing to hear this man saying that, you know, because what is an atheist then? So if you look up the classic definition of an atheist is somebody that says, I don't believe in God because there's no evidence for it. That's an atheist. We are very familiar with anti-theists, and we all just chuck them in the same basket, and we call them atheists anyway. But there's an anti-theist that's one that says, I don't believe in God, and I believe that your belief in this God is dangerous. It's destructive to humanity. And so I'll attack it, like Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins and all of those kind of guys. They actively attack what we believe in because they say that this thing is bad for society. That's an anti-theist. But there's this third category, which is this Attenborough. He's an agnostic. Okay. And an agnostic is an interesting one because I believe that there's a lot of hope for the agnostic. And the agnostic also, he encourages me because of what this Attenborough said. He said he opened a termite heap one day. And he said he was standing above the termite heap and he was looking down into it. He said these termites were completely and utterly unaware of him because they're blind. And they're controlled by some force inside that termite heap there that keeps them moving and working in complete and utter agreement with one another. Eugene Marais wrote a book, you know, Die Ziel von dem Meer. And he describes this termite heap. It's an absolutely miraculous thing as a termite heap, because the individual termites they part of the whole body is the termite heap, and they're so pre-programmed that if you had to take a termite heap, a meerwurper, and you knocked a steel plate into the termite heap, down into it like that, they would carry on building their little tunnels and things like that from two sides of the tunnel, such that the two parts of the tunnel from the team building this side and the team building that side would match up perfectly on either side of the steel plate. How do they do that? It's like 3D printing, you know, that the ones on this side, they know where the tunnel needs to go here, and that one over there comes in and joins up. It joins up perfectly where the steel plate is. How? What's a sintaya etala? You know, what senses do they have to do this? But the sense that they don't have the sense to know that David Attenborough is standing looking down at them, checking them out. And I start thinking to myself, I wonder if I'm not a termite. I wonder that I don't have the sense to know who's looking down on me right now. Somebody who's just outside of the visible light that I can see is right here next to me. His name is Jesus. And he's just outside the infrared or the ultraviolet. His spirit is right here. Surely with such a limited amount of senses at my disposal, there's a lot that I don't know. And there's a lot that I can't know. And I have to get to the point where I say, Lord, I believe, but help me in my unbelief. Because even in that case where the father had been praying for years for his epileptic son, and the man confesses, help me in my doubt, Jesus is merciful with him, and he heals the little boy. And that's my God. That's the one that I want to walk with. That's the one that accepts me, warts and all. That's the one that says, I see you. Maybe you don't. Maybe you don't have the eyes or the ears or the touch, but I'm here. Helen Keller. She was deaf and she was blind. Can you imagine that? All you can do is you can touch. And Anne Sullivan, her teacher, she taught her the first word by signaling on her hand after she had put her hands into cold water. She taught her the word water. By the end of that day, Helen Keller knew 30 words. She went on to write books to influence generations of people. When she was asked about God, she said, I knew he was there, but I didn't know his name. And let me tell you today, I know he's there. And let me tell you his name. His name's Jesus. Thank you.